Welcome, everyone, to tonight's teleseminar with Karen Scholl. We have several topics picked out for this evening, the first being stall tantrum, followed by television show, nibbling on the trail, and bits. So, Karen, here's the first question.
Okay.
Hi, Karen. I've had a 16-year-old pony mare for about 2 years. She works very well with us as a lesson horse, loves to do trail rides, and for the most part is a very good girl. But her vice is bucking in the stall. When tied, she stands and seems happy, but I only tie her when brushing or saddling. If she's loose in her stall and is not with her hay, water, or to be let out, she lets loose with a tantrum. She has 5 other pasture mates, and they coexist outside well enough. Should I keep her tied all the time when in the barn? I don't want her to develop a bad attitude when tied in her stall. I would appreciate any ideas. Thanks, Shelley in Maine.
You know, it's really an interesting, behavior to develop. You know, it's a fairly unusual behavior. Not that horses don't have other behaviors in stalls, pawing, whinnying, cribbing, you know, fill in the blank. But to stand there and actually buck in the stall requires a lot of exertion for the horse. So that's why I say it's unusual, because usually horses do things like, you know, pawing takes exertion, cribbing takes exertion, and also becomes highly addictive to the horse because it releases endorphins. They actually become addicted to the endorphin release during cribbing. So it's unusual in that, you know, sense of things. You know, the ideal for horses, you know, if you just look at a prey animal in its natural state, is for lots of movement, you know, continuously throughout the day. So we don't always have that option, you know, for our horses. So, you know, for horses in the wild, they're designed to go about 20 miles a day, just browsing and grazing, and, you know, they hardly even go into a trot for much of any reason unless they, you know, perceive a threat or, you know, something like that, or they have to travel, you know, cover a lot of ground. But usually they're just kind of, you know, moseying along and grazing unless they're, you know, traveling to, you know, summer pastures or something like that and going through kind of, you know, in between areas. So, you know, when we look at not, you know, trying to meet the needs of our horses, you know, they're designed to be around other horses. They're designed to have interaction with other individuals. One of the most difficult things for horses to bear is the same thing that's the most difficult for humans to bear, which is solitary confinement. So that's why people keep goats around horses. You know, it's kind of traditional in a lot of barns that the goats kind of have, you know, free roaming access to all the stalls. You know, the stalls are set up so the goats can kind of come in and out and around and about. So all the horses have that satisfaction of another, you know, individual that they're, even if it's not interacting directly, there's an animal that comes into their presence. So what it sounds like to me is that this horse is very gregarious, and when the person is in there, see, I don't know that it's tied. It could be that the behavior isn't demonstrated when the horse is tied, because the horse associates being tied to interacting with people and therefore being used for an activity. So it can be just that the horse, this behavior came along where the horse, you know, was standing in the stall, the other horses, you know, they couldn't get to the other horses or wasn't anybody around, and the horse starts, you know, jumping up and down in the stall. Now, what happens when horses demonstrate these behaviors is, you know, that's our opportunity to respond to it. So if a horse is bucking up and down a stall and we go over to it and we go in with it, and then we proceed to take it out or brush it or even go in and say, quit it, you know, things like that, but the horse pieces together in their mind is that I buck in the stall and people come. So it's kind of an interesting, you know, behavior that would develop, because for it to become as consistent as you're describing, it would need, I would examine kind of in the past okay, what was our response when the horse was bucking in the stall? Because I don't know many horses, it's not to say that they can't, but I don't know many horses who would buck for very long, you know, because it's not that horses are lazy, they're efficient. So to put that kind of effort to have continuous bucking, you know, indefinitely, it would be unusual. So if we look at that and say, okay, you know, whatever happened, you know, when the horse started bucking, this is how, you know, we responded to it. Now the question is then, okay, how do we reshape that behavior? So if it were me, I would make sure that the stall is completely safe. There's nothing that the horse can kick through or jump over or, you know, really get into too much trouble. And I would sit back out of sight and watch, you know, to where the horse can't see me. And then I'd just watch, and the horse would be jumping up and down, jumping up and down, jumping up and down. And I may even stop and look around like, you know, well, nobody's looking at me. In the moment that it stops, go over to the stall and go, hey, how's it going? And then walk away into your hiding spot again. And just watch from a distance when the horse is jumping up and down, jumping up and down, jumping down. You just stay away from there. It's hard to do at first. And it may take quite a while, but even if the horse stops bucking, even just because it looked at a cat walking down the, you know, barn aisle or for any reason, then go out there. So pretty soon the horse starts saying, creating the association of, when all four feet are on the ground, people come. Okay? So it's a very kind of a simplistic approach to things, but one of the hardest things is to, you know, watch a horse jumping up and down, you know, jumping around like a marlin and thinking, well, I should go in there and do something about it. But if it goes back to the type of scenario where that horse says, you know, I need another individual, you know, around me to feel safe, to feel confident, to, you know, whatever it is, it's a very easy thing to inadvertently reinforce. You know, we do this all the time. Horses paw at the rail. They'll stand there and paw. And we go, even if we go over there to, quote, you know, discipline them and say, quit it. Well, we walk up and the horse stops it and we go, quit it. And then they do. And we think, I did that. I got them to quit. And we walk away. As soon as we walk away, the horse starts pawing again. Now, cribbing's a different creature. That's a whole different subject. But these kinds of behaviors like pawing, banging on the rail, all these kinds of things, we don't realize that we inadvertently reinforce some of those things. And once it's a reinforced behavior, even once, you know, I like to ask, you know, people the question, how many times does it take to give a kid a candy bar in a grocery store before you have a problem? You know, kid pitches a fit, mom goes, oh my gosh, I don't want to deal with this today, you know, whatever reason, gives the kid the candy bar, and boy, you've got a real task on your hands after that. So, you know, we don't realize that we're doing those things, you know, sometimes. So then we think, okay, how do we, you know, help this situation? Sometimes it's hard if you have a busy barn because people are just walking by and they may not be somebody that's, you know, familiar with what you're trying to do with a horse. So, you know, the horse sees one of your customers or kids walking by and they start jumping up and down, and then curious people or concerned people come over and go, oh, what's wrong, darling? And the horse goes, nothing, I got you to come over here and look lovingly into my eyes. So, you know, we don't always realize that the environment is kind of contributing to these things. So sometimes people, you know, have it in their mind, not often, but sometimes people say, well, they just like to do that. Well, here's my question then. If the horse is out, you know, in the pasture or with other horses, does it do it then? Does it just, you know, be sitting there hanging out in the pasture and then just suddenly go, hey, I forgot, I like to buck, and they just start jumping up and down, bucking, you know, incessantly in the pasture. You know, you don't usually see it. It's usually in an environment where it's affecting the horse at an emotional level. And that emotional level is tied into the survival mechanism that nature instills into prey animals, which says my safety, my security, my confidence is drawn from other individuals being around me. So hopefully that'll give you some insight as to how that pattern of behavior might have developed. I'm not saying it did, but I'm just, you know, kind of good guessing here. And then think, okay, how do I reinforce that? Because this is the thing, you know, if the hay's there, the horse doesn't buck. So sometimes it's just a horse sitting there, you know, bucking, and we go, hang on a minute, the hay's coming, okay? And then we go, well, feeding time's at, you know, 7 o'clock or, you know, whatever it is. So we go down the road, and we don't realize the horse is jumping up and down the stall when the hay comes. So the horse starts creating that association, you know, to those kinds of things. And, you know, I haven't met a horse that having that kind of understanding doesn't reshape that behavior, you know, and it took time to develop it, so it's going to naturally take time to shape it into something else. So I know I brought this up in teleseminars before, but there were a couple of friends who were, had a lovely facility. They asked if I would, you know, enjoy staying at their facility, and they were gone for one of the months out of the summer, and you know, I just flew to my events out of there. It worked out great, but their horses, you know, were there in the pens, and it was really interesting because they said, no, you know, the horses bang on the stalls at feeding time, and I just, you know, in the back of my mind went, oh, okay, you know. So they were trying to tell me, like, oh, this is how our horses act, and I went, okay. So, you know, sure enough, they'd hear the front door in the morning, and I'd go out, and the banging on these, you know, metal pipe corrals would commence, and the whole way down the hill, it just, you know, get louder and more insistent, and I'd go down, and I'd look at them. You know, they're all fine. I didn't, you know, they weren't hurting the pipe fence, and they weren't hurting themselves, and I just proceeded to, you know, go around and straighten up, do some other chores, you know, go up, clean the stalls, you know, kind of look around, check things in the morning like you do, and then they kept banging on the pipe rail, and I went back on up to the house and had a cup of coffee. And the look on these horses' face was like, what the heck is this deal? See? So I went out a little bit later, you know, 10, 15 minutes later, they're saying, they are banging to beat the band. I just went down there, moseyed around, went back up to the house, you know, had my second cup of coffee. I mean, it didn't take long before the horses started going, the human comes down to the barn, it doesn't necessarily mean food is coming. The moment they were standing quietly, and even if it was quite by accident, then I would throw the feed. So, you know, how long did that take to reshape that behavior of many, many years? It took about, I don't know, 2 days. And those horses learned that when I come down, boy, if I hold my feet still, the, you know, breakfast is coming. So, but it's hard. You know, sometimes it's hard in our schedule. You know, we have a lot of horses to feed or something like that. We don't realize that, you know, a horse may do something simple as just pinning its ears when the hay comes. You know, and the hay gets thrown in and the horse creates an association that I pinned my ears and got you to drop the hay. So, you know, it's something as simple as that. Other places I've been to where, you know, I've had the hay and the horses were all in the habit of, you know, about half of them would pin their ears, and I'd just stand there and wait because pinning your ears even takes a muscle, you know. And pretty soon they'd stand there with their ears just flat back, and then they'd just kind of turn an ear towards me just a little bit like, what are you doing? And, boy, I'd drop the hay. And it took, again, probably 2 or 3 days for me to walk down the lane, and those horses just looked at me with their ears forward, expression bright, going, hi, how are you doing? I go, great, you know. So, you know, feeding time is a big deal. It's a huge motivation for horses. Again, looking at horses, you know, by nature, they're designed to eat little bits of food continuously all day long. They're not designed for 2 meals a day or even 3 meals a day. 3 is better than 2, but you know, it's still not what a horse is designed, you know, how to eat. That's something that I really like on the market. If you want to look at are things like slow grazers, where you put the hay into usually it's a metal box and it pushes the hay up against a screen that the horses, it actually simulates the grazing activity that they would do, you know, out in the wild. They just get little bits. They don't just gulp all their food and 40 minutes later they're sitting around, you know, waiting for their next meal. So horses' stomachs are not very large. They're very small. They're not designed to eat a big meal and then go to nothing, you know, for another 10 hours. So sometimes that creates those kinds of behaviors where horses paw or, you know, jump up and down because they're not designed to operate on an empty stomach. It's just not their nature, you know, to do that. So that's something else to consider as well. I don't think it'd be something in the physiology because, you know, I want to eliminate that from my thought process because, it, like I said in the very beginning, it takes a lot of energy and physiology for a horse to jump up and down, you know, standing still. You know, if you looked in the dressage world, that would be called, you know, lavat is forward movement, but, you know, pee-off or, you know, some of these kind of, you know, you can look in there and say, oh, he's doing errors above the ground. That's big bucks, you know, in some circles. So, you know, take that approach and kind of look at it with a fresh set of eyes and just see if there isn't something in the environment that you can do or change to, you know, reshape that behavior. And then just take your time and just chip away at it and see if it just doesn't get less and less and less until it becomes, you know, a thing of past. But hopefully I gave you some ideas for an approach that'll help that situation. And I really appreciate you sending in your question.
Well, thanks, Karen. That's a lot of good ideas for Shelley to think about and see if she can find something that'll help her horse's behavior in the stall.
Great.
The next one is a pretty short question. It says, hi, Karen. I really miss your show on TV. Will you be televising more, or is there a place I can still watch your shows? Susan in Arizona.
Gosh, and thanks for enjoying the show when it was being aired. The channel that was airing it on Dish Network actually changed the format, and that's why it's no longer being aired. There's, you know, as most people know, there's a couple other horse-dedicated formats. You know, they're a pay-per-view or, you know, pay-for-that-channel type of a format. And I've been on those shows. I've been on RFD TV a couple of times under Horse City show for some episodes there. I don't know that I'll be, you know, airing my show on there. It's just kind of, I don't know that I want to explain it publicly, but it's kind of for personal reasons. So, you know, I'm always, you know, open to airing it on another channel if, you know, there's an opportunity, because I think that, you know, people are getting access to so much great information, you know, on everything from horses to, you know, how to auction at storage units, how to golf well, you know, I saw a hunting show this morning. You know, there's so much great access to so many activities, you know, with so many channels that we have nowadays. And, you know, I'd love to contribute to people's knowledge about horses, you know, with, you know, free access TV. But, you know, we always keep an open mind, you know, to doing that. In the meantime, you can go online and download the 12 episodes of my show. Sorry, not download it, but get the DVDs of those 12 episodes. So you can have those in your video library, your horse education video library, and I encourage, you know, people to do that because there's so many different subjects, you know, that those episodes covered, and the folks that were airing them from on the channel that was on Dish Network, you know, even the technicians, you know, I was in the studio one day and the technician said, oh, you're that horse lady. They said, yours is one of our favorite shows. He said, yours is one of the few that, like, we like to watch. So, you know, it was a huge compliment, and I really enjoyed doing the shows, and I would like to do more. So it's just probably a matter of time before regular television show, you know, gets produced and gets out there, and, you know, it's a matter of getting sponsors and, you know, all those fun things. So, you know, spending a lot of time educating people with horses, sometimes it's a pretty big balance to running business behind, you know, what it appears to be just, you know, Karen shows up and, you know, helps people with their horses for 3 days, but there's a lot of behind the scenes going on to produce something like that. So, you know, it's always something that's in the back of my mind to do. We've done it, you know, to an extent, but we haven't done it, you know, quite to that full extent. But not to say that we won't one day. So, but I really appreciate the question. I really appreciate that you enjoyed the shows, and that's why we moved the shows onto the DVD format so people could still enjoy the shows even though they're not being aired right now.
Thanks, Karen. I'll describe the DVDs just a little bit. There's 3 episodes per DVD, so that's an hour and a half of education. And there's 4 DVDs. The first one deals a lot with the psychology of horses, the foundational information. And there's one episode on commonly misunderstood techniques that help people get unstuck from a place where they've been stuck with their horses. And that's a really terrific episode to get your horsemanship going again. Another deals with trail riding, 3 episodes on trail riding. Another one on safe saddling and finding the ideal horse. So if you're in the market for either of those or you want to know how to saddle more safely, that's for you. And the 4th DVD is about learning all about ranch roping and how to throw a rope. And that's something fun that you can do with your horse and with your friends. It's not too difficult. And so, Karen, I don't know if you want to add anything else about those DVDs, but they're a really terrific series.
Yeah. You know, the series on ranch roping was filmed with Dan Moyer, who's a very good friend of mine in Colorado, at Cowboys in Colorado. And he has just an exceptional way of explaining ranch roping, which is not what you see. It's not the type of roping that you see with team roping, and other, roping kind of activities. I like to describe ranch roping as being like the fly fishing of fishing, the fishing world. It's an art form. So, and there's something, if you don't feel comfortable with a rope, it doesn't matter. A lot of times people go, I'm a recreational rider, I'm not going to, pick up a rope, never see cattle, anything like that. It doesn't matter. Anytime you handle a rope, you're developing your feel and your timing and your release. You're improving your skills with horses. So it seems unrelated. You may not even, handle a rope around your horse or cattle or anything ever. But even just handling the rope and learning the throws helps you get a feel. There's a phrase called getting friendly with your rope. So the more familiar you become, where that rope becomes an extension of you, all of that feel and that skill and experience all transmits into your feel and experience with your horse. So sometimes people look at that and they go, we just dismiss it so quickly. And yet if it's something that I put out there, it's something that I feel is very valuable for people who want to develop their skills and their experience. And it doesn't matter, it doesn't matter how old you are, athletic you are, or if you've ever even thrown a rope before. In fact, talking with Dan Moyer about teaching people, he's a clinician as well. And when he teaches people, he's found the same thing I found. The easiest person to teach is the person with the least amount of experience, because they haven't even developed a muscle memory that maybe you have to, shift and change. Somebody who comes up and says, "Karen, I don't know anything about horses," I get excited on the inside because I go, "Wow, here's, a clean slate." It's like somebody comes to me, brings a colt to me, and I go, "Ooh, this is going to be fun." When somebody comes along and says, "Oh, I've, ridden horses for 20 years," they may be highly skilled, but maybe not. Having experience with horses or experience, you can have a horse that's been, 20 years old and ridden every day of his life, and it doesn't mean that they're, conditioned to be light and responsive and, soft and, all those things, as everybody's kind of familiar with. So don't dismiss some of those things. Even if you get the DVD and watch it and go, I think most people watch to get it, don't think they're ever going to rope anything, and then they look at it and they go, that looks like something that I can do. So Dan Moyer is an exceptional individual. He has a way of explaining things that is totally non-threatening, non-intimidating, totally supportive, and you would know that if you're familiar with my program. I just wouldn't have somebody, I wouldn't shoot a video with somebody that I didn't find it just incredibly exceptional in their, not only their skill and ability, but in their teaching ability as well. So those are 2 different things, as most of us, somebody can be very good at something and yet not have the skill to explain it so that the rest of us, can do it as well. So, take a look at that too, And if you don't like it, anything, you know, on my website, if I offer anything on my website, if you get a DVD and you go, you know what, this isn't what I thought, I tried it like Karen said and I don't like it, send it back. I don't want you to have anything of mine that you don't like. So, you know, it's not even a risky kind of a deal. It's not, you know, I've been stuck with things, and I know people have that hesitation as well. But if you get something and you go, this isn't what I thought, I don't like it, I don't want you to keep it. You know, I want you to send it back to me, and we'll give your money back, you know, no questions asked. So, you know, you can kind of put your mind at ease, you know, and have more confidence, more buying confidence when you're looking at things on my website.
Well, that's terrific. The website is KarenScholl.com. Click on the button that says television shows, and there's even, I believe, two-minute segments of each of the DVDs there that you can watch a little bit of the video and see if it's something that you're interested in and would like to add to your video library. The next topic is nibbling on the trail. I have a great 12-year-old mare whose worst habit is biting at weeds and grass while we ride. I've tried turning her in circles every time she does this, as well as moving her into a trot immediately. These maneuvers do not seem to work. I'm concerned one of us may get hurt if I cannot stop this annoying behavior. Any suggestions would be most appreciated. Thank you, Melanie.
You know, we've talked about this in previous teleseminars, but this one, how you described your question there, Melanie, puts a little bit of a question in my mind. So, you know, it's interesting in the horse industry across the board when we have trouble with horses. It seems like one of the first options we go to, just maybe it's just being human, is we go to the circle thing, as if circling the horse is going to cause the horse to go, oh, that was too much punishment, I shouldn't do that again. You know, I just taught a clinic in Grand Junction, Colorado last weekend, and folks were having trouble trailer loading a horse. And they asked me to actually made a special trip Monday morning out to the facility to help out. And so, you know, I was asking, okay, what have you done? What are you doing? And, you know, there's even the same thing, you know, at the trailer, circle, 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 rest at the trailer. It's not that it's those are bad techniques. I just don't find that it affects the behavioral change that we're looking for. And that's why you're sending in your question, which, you know, I want to thank you for, you know, because a lot of people have these kinds of problems. So I just want to mention that because it seems to be when we have trouble with a horse, we tend to go to the circle, okay? So one of the things to think about with horses is that they go six different directions. They go forwards, backwards, right, left, up, and down. And some horses can do all six at once, you know, very quickly. So the number one direction that horses go is forwards. That's number one. I mean, they, you know, they spend all day going forwards. They usually don't go sideways and usually don't go backwards to eat grass or just, you know, when they're just standing out there, you know, you don't turn them out in the arena and watch them, you know, going sideways too much or backwards too much, you know, without it. But if you put another horse out there and they start playing leadership games out there, then you'll start seeing sideways. You'll start seeing backwards. So sometimes the forward motion of a walk or a circle or even a trot is not enough consequence for the horse to say, you know what, I'm not really hungry right now. That's what you're looking for, is how do I respond to this if the horse says, what grass? You know, I really am enjoying my trail ride right now. And it, you know, you'd be convinced, you know, how some horses behave that you never feed them, you know, and usually they're the, you know, voluptuous ones going on. I just need that little molecule, that little twig as it's going by. So something to think about, when horses go to nibble on grass or nibble on twigs, usually the position, not always, sometimes they'll put their nose sideways or up to nibble something that's kind of, you know, shoulder height. But usually to do that, their nose needs to go down, okay, so down to their knees or lower. So kind of a neat thing to do when a horse grazes on the trail or, you know, when they're going along and they just, you know, stick their nose on the ground, and some of them are really good at it. Like, they'll take the reins right out of your hand. You've seen little kids just about get unseated, you know, pulled off over their head when a horse learns that they can, you know, root on the bit. But the thing I like to do is not to pull them up with my reins, again, because it doesn't change the desire. What I like to do is talk to the hindquarters. So when, and you can do this online on the ground first, which is what I advise. You know, because somehow when we get up on the horse's back and you start doing things and it's the horse, you know, we get a little more hesitant up there because we don't want the horse to, you know, jump out from under us suddenly. So it's something that you can do on the ground. So I'll give you an example. I've had clinics where we've had too much moisture and the arena is just knee-deep in mud. So we'll go out into a big grassy area. Everybody looks at me and says, we can't have a clinic out here. You know, all my horse is going to do is going to sit here and eat grass. So I teach them the technique. It's just halter and lead, you know, 12-foot line. Use an extension of your hand, which is a, you know, teaching stick, which, you know, is on my website, but you see lots of them out there in the, you know, in the industry. But all I do is when the horse puts its head down uninvited and starts eating grass, I think of putting pressure on the very top of the hip, the highest point on the hip. So I'm going to pick up my stick, wave it above the hip, start tapping the top of the hip, keeping the rope short enough that the horse can't, you know, throw its hip towards me and, you know, clock me one and can, so it can finish its breakfast. You know, keep the lead rope short enough that you can turn the nose towards you and start tapping lightly with rhythm continuously firmer until it's firm enough to cause the horse to pick his head up out of the grass. Okay? So, and then the horse will stand there for a moment. You quit immediately. The moment the head comes up, you take the pressure away, put the stick down to your side, and just stand there relaxed and go, boy, look at all this grass. And the horse looks at you and goes, oh, I really want that grass. And he sticks his nose back down in the grass. Proceed again. It's not with an approach of punishment or dominance or anything like that. It's just, hey, you want to eat grass? Resist the urge to pull the head up. Just make sure you have the lead line short enough that you can turn the nose to you so you can protect, you'll be protected. And that's why you want to use an extension of your arm. So you can put pressure on the hip, but have your physical body, you know, far enough away that the horse, you know, wouldn't be able to, you know, kick out at you, reach you if they did kick out. So you start again with pressure on top of the hip. Horse picks up its head, take the pressure away. It really doesn't take very long, most of the time less than 5 minutes. And that horse is standing there on a loose rein, and it says, you know what, every time I eat grass, my butt hurts. See? And so pretty soon the horse says, I didn't want that grass anyway. Okay? But you have to be willing to go to a point where it's firm enough, but without getting emotional. That's a big part when I talk to people about, you know, using the physical pressure with a horse, not for punishment, but for communication with a horse. It, to put the kind of pressure on to change the horse's mind about a behavior, but without getting emotional about it or without getting mean or mad. How I look at something that helps me is that I just look at behaviors as patterns of behavior. It's not that horse that's trying to make a monkey out of you or anything. That horse has just developed a pattern of behavior that we have the opportunity to respond in a different way to cause the horse to change his mind about that behavior. And that's a really important piece of these things, because once we get emotional about it or get frustrated with it, then our mind goes somewhere else and we're not even thinking right. And that's when we get into trouble. We're not aware of how long the lead line is, where we lose our awareness of how much pressure there is. And it's not about going in and, you know, I had somebody in the clinic last weekend that says, oh, I get it. I whack my horse. And I go, oh, please don't say that. That is not even, you know, the word choice that I would use. It's, if you do that, that horse has the right to whack you back. So it's just about the type of communication that you offer to the horse that allows that horse to change its mind about that behavior. So once you do that on the ground, then take it up riding. And don't go out on a trail ride and go, okay, now I'm on the trail ride, now it's happening, now I'm going to, you know, change this deal. Set it up so that you can simulate, you can recreate the situation without being around a bunch of horses and people, and if your horse moves, he's going to knock somebody down the hill or anything like that. Go into, you know, a safe environment, wide open space, and just fiddle around with it. Just fiddle around with it until that horse says, you know what, I'm with you, and you'll let me know when I get to eat grass. And I go, you bet, I'll let you know when you get to eat grass. It becomes so good so fast that what the second piece I try to share with people is to create a cue or a communication to ask your horse to lower their head and eat grass, even when you're on the trail. Now, this may be down the road for you because your horse has the pattern of doing that anyway, but why not be, you know, you're out on a half-day trail ride and you get up to a beautiful grassy meadow and you're going to step off and, you know, and have some lunch or something. Why not create a cue, even from up on the horse's back where you put pressure, like right behind the pole, ask them to lower their head, invite them to eat grass. Because now you have the communication to put wave a little bit of pressure at the hindquarters and say, okay, now you don't eat grass. And I tie you up to the tree or the hitching rail or whatever it is, a trailer, you know, to have your lunch. So if you can ask a horse to not eat grass, why not create a communication that says, you know what, here's a wonderful bit of, you know, your this winter, our winter grass will start coming up in the desert, and it's just, you know, really sweet to the horses. They really enjoy it. So I go out on a trail ride, and I find a nice grassy spot out there, and I'll reach forward and put a little bit of pressure on my horse's mane. I invite them to eat that grass. They sit there and, you know, eat along, munch away, and then when I'm ready to go, I just pick them up, put a little bit of pressure towards the hindquarters, and they pick their head up, and then they go just a little bit more, and I go, nope. Let's go. And off we go. So that's what's possible with horses. So rather than getting, you know, dogmatic about, you know, always this or always that, you know, that kind of a thing, just try to think about adding to your ability to communicate to the horse what it is that you'd like them to do at this moment in time. And again, make it your decision. You know, make it whether to eat grass or not eat grass, you know, that's your decision. So it's kind of a fun thing, you know, to do with horses. But, you know, I can go along on a trail ride and stop somewhere and my horse just stands there and other people are getting pulled out of their saddle. Their horse is trying to eat the, you know, beautiful grass we've stopped in. And, you know, I just think in the back of my mind, if they just had this information, they would know how to respond to that and to create the kind of communication and respect that a horse can have for the person to sit there and wait. And I may not ask my horse to eat grass at all, and he's okay with that too, okay? So it's just whatever your decision is at that moment in time. That's the possibility I want to offer to you. So give that a try, and I'd love to hear how that goes.
Thanks for that, Karen. That's great advice. And, boy, when that behavior is finally modified, the trail rides are so much more fun and safe.
Yeah, so much more pleasant. Now I will tell you, you know, I went along in an area up in the mountains in Colorado, and they've got so much rain that the grass was literally chest high. So that was a tough one, you know, to have my horse walk along, and, you know, the grass is brushing his muzzle, you know, while he's walking. That was a challenging environment. But, yeah, I think for most environments that technique just works really, really well. And it's not a fight anymore for you.
Here's the last question. It's about bit. I've taken on a 10-year-old 12-hand Welsh gelding. He's been doing Western classes before I got him, and I was told he also went English, including some jumping. I put a rubber-covered D-ring snaffle on him, and he fights at something awful. His owner gave me a Tom Thumb Western bit that she used on him. I don't like it at all and cannot use it as I have no training in Western and I don't teach it. I found a thin snaffle with rubber discs on the side to keep it from being pulled through his mouth. I lunged him for 30 minutes in this, and he was better somewhat on a trail ride, but in the ring he fights the children when they ask him to stop, even though they are taught to ask kindly. What's the best way to retrain this little fellow to accept an English bit and respond to kind hands? Judy.
I'll tell you, that is a really tough question, because when you're using a horse for a lesson horse, you have, you know, I mean, that's what lessons are for, is to, you know, have every kind of skill level, you know, on the planet, handling a horse. So the thing that I do find, though, is that rubber to horses, to me, you know, it doesn't really taste good. It doesn't taste good. And it's usually a larger diameter because of the rubber coating around it. So, you know, it's not as comfortable in the horse's mouth as well. Something I like to do with bits when I'm, you know, in a tack store is, you know, and don't let anybody catch you doing this, but put the bit in your own mouth. You know, put it in your mouth. If you put a rubber bit in your mouth and you go, yuck, you know, horses are extremely sensitive. You know, they'll pick out the little, you know, molecules of oats around the pill. You know, you can reassemble a crushed pill, you know, into an entire pill when it's done. So horses are extremely sensitive to taste, to smell, all of those things, even more so than us. We know that about animals. Their sensitivity to smell and taste is even greater than ours. So to me, rubber bits are not comfortable, nor are they you know, appealing in the taste category as well. So the bit that I use, and it's, you know, people looked at me, it was, you know, this last weekend, one of the participants, class participants, was asking me a similar question. And she said, I noticed you only carry one bit. And I said, that's right. I said, you know, the moment I find another bit, and I look for bits, I go to the Denver market every year, I go into every tack shop, I look at other people's bits, you know, when they come to clinics. When I find another bit I like better, that one will be on the website. But the bit that I carry, it's made by Jeremiah Watt Products. It is a sweet iron loose ring snaffle bit. So it is designed, it's very light. It's not that it's thin, but it's the mouthpiece is lightweight. I set the bit in the horse's mouth loose enough that the horse picks up and holds the bit in their mouth. So when I say that this is a difficult question, the reason that it's difficult is, you know, it's not difficult to answer. It's just an pretty extensive answer. So I'll give you kind of some, you know, big pieces of this. Traditionally, and I've taken lots of English courses. I rode English when I, you know, first started riding horses. The idea is that, you know, when a bit is properly fit, traditionally, is that, you know, the horse has a wrinkle in the corner of the mouth. You know, one wrinkle's good, two's better. I've seen people recommend three. To me, if the horse has that much pressure in the mouth to form wrinkles in the corner of the mouth, then the ring pressure, just think about this for a minute. If the horse is feeling even 20 ounces of pressure in the mouth, that doesn't seem like a whole lot. But if it's 20 ounces continuously, then for the horse to feel any difference, it has to go to 21 ounces in the hands before the horse even can feel the difference, okay? So you can feel this yourself by taking a bit and having somebody holding the head stall, and you push down on that bit enough to form wrinkles in your hand on both sides. And to form those wrinkles, you'll be amazed. I mean, it always shocks people how much pressure there is to form wrinkles in the corners of the, you know, skin and tissue on your hand. And there's not much difference, you know, in the horse's mouth, especially on the thumb side of the hand. So that's quite a bit of pressure to form that. So when people talk about a hard mouth force, what's happening is the horse feels pressure all the time, all the time, all the time, and so it becomes desensitized to it. You know, we put the bridle in and we fit it up, you know, tight, and then we think, okay, here we go, and then the horse doesn't listen to our reins. Well, if you think about that, the horse is feeling, you know, that much pressure continuously, nonstop, from the time the bridle goes on to when the time the bridle comes off. How can they feel the pressure on the reins? So when I have a horse, when I recondition a horse, and this is what I'm suggesting to you because that's what you're describing, you want to know how to recondition this horse to have a light feel on the reins. And there's a whole, you know, study to that. You know, our acceleration and deceleration of a horse comes from our seats. Turning the horse comes from our legs. Then if you use the reins, say my seat activates for an upward transition, my seat deactivates for a downward transition. If the horse doesn't make the downward transition, then I go through the stages to pick up my reins, run my hand down the reins, slow the horse down. So I'm not going to use my reins to stop the horse. I'm going to use my reins if the horse doesn't stop. Okay? I'm not going to use my reins to turn the horse. I'm going to use the reins if my horse doesn't turn from the change in my focus, change in my body position, and change in the feel of my leg along the side. So when you start thinking of those possibilities, now you start, you know, the mind starts opening and going, well, you know, how is that possible? How do you get there? How do you do that? Okay? And that's where I suggest to people, if you really want to recondition this horse to find true lightness, you know, to, you know, Tom Dorans wrote about true unity. When we're looking for that true connection, then it's about how do we develop our communication in such a way, how do we offer the type of communication that that horse, you know, when I ride my horse, it's like I'm putting, you know, it's physical. I just like my car, I'll put my foot on the gas and I'll accelerate. My energy in my body is what's transmitted, you know, first. And then when you know, this is called riding, not sitting, you know, we activate, the energy in your body. Then when I want the horse to slow or stop, I deactivate. I release that. I, you know, feel like a, you know, a sack of potatoes. And if the horse doesn't recognize that first stage, then I go through the steps to pick up the reins, bending. And even if I need to bend the horse down one rein, you know, shut him down to a stop, take the hindquarters away if I need to get that horse to start recognizing the sequence of when my seat activates to when it deactivates. So this is, in my opinion, how we're taught to ride horses traditionally. It doesn't matter, English, Western, you know, fill in blank. We tend to gravitate more towards, you know, using our reins all the time. And so when you look at demonstrations, and you see all kinds of things on, you know, YouTube, I do bridleless demos at expos and things like that, and people say, well, why would you ride bridleless? You know, what's the point in that? Well, to me, that just proves to me that I have total influence over my horse in speed and direction. And then my goal is then when I have that, then I add a bit to refine the communication. You know, to me, the ultimate, to have a horse reach that ultimate lightness, is that the horse is reading my seat and my legs. And then my hands just help pick up that horse to help him be in the frame for him to find even more precision and more athleticism in his movement that my seat and my legs are communicating. Okay? So it's a bit like ballroom dancing where, you know, the partners are dancing together in this structured kind of a frame. And they pick each other up so they can be in a more athletic and elegant position to perform the maneuvers. To me, that's the ultimate, you know, with horses. So in the scenario that you're describing, you have, you know, it sounds like a nice little lesson horse that, you know, he's been ridden English, he's been ridden Western. You know, I think that the lesson horses should get the gold medal, you know, at the Olympics because they tolerate. You know, a good lesson horse is worth their weight in gold because they tolerate our current skill level. You know, they put up with us as we, you know, get better and better and better. So you've got a bit of a challenge there because you have so many different people coming in using this horse. So is he going to get conflicting signals? Absolutely, you know. But that's what a lesson horse's job is to kind of tolerate, you know, the person's current ability, and hopefully when they're done with that lesson or a series of lessons, that ability improves. So, but if you're asking me how do I help this horse become lighter and more responsive to pressure inside of the mouth, what I would do is take that horse out of the lesson environment for a period of time and then just go back to the foundation. I would go back to the riding from the ground techniques. I go back to just pressure on the outside of the nose using a soft rope halter. I'd go back to just taking up the pressure gradually and offering that horse pressure in such a way that he doesn't feel defensive and therefore causing him to become bracy. You know, that's what I did, you know, for the over the three-day clinic there with a group of people up in Colorado. And there were horses that had been ridden their whole lives, you know, at different stages by different people of different skills and abilities. But it's always going back to how can I re-educate this horse to let him know that there's a sequence of communication being offered. And then and we're trying to give the person the ability to offer that communication with a level of clarity that the horse can recognize what's being asked of them and then respond, you know, accordingly. So even my horses, they're passed away now of old age, but, you know, I tend to think of my old horses, Dajan and Crumpet, and, you know, some folks use them for different clinics when they had to fly in and couldn't bring their horse, different scenarios. But what was really amazing is to watch those horses who, you know, I could ride both of them in, you know, collection and beautiful lightness. I could ride them bareback and bridleless, lay them down. I mean, incredible things. And I would hand those horses to, you know, a person taking the clinic. And it was so amusing to me because I'd look at those horses kind of looking around like, I've never done this before in my life. I don't know what you're talking about. They would not pretend that they didn't know it, but they really didn't understand. You know, as soon as the person got it right, they got it right because it was already, you know, it's like a computer. The program was installed. But until the person got it right, they would just look at him with this blank look like, you know, keep trying, you know, you're not quite there yet. So they almost act like, well, I don't even know this. But they really didn't know it because the person was, you know, asking the horse for behavior, you know, at the level that they were at. But that's why they made great lesson horses because, you know, they're pretty forgiving and they kind of would just go along and kind of half-heartedly do things. And the person, you know, as they built their confidence and got the right kind of feel and the release and all these kind of things, you know, the horses were right there for them. So it's a challenge. It really is a challenge. And some horses have it in their nature to support a person at the learning level, and some horses don't. So, you know, that's something that you already know if you're, you know, have a group of lesson horses, you already have experienced that. You know, conversely, my two mares who, you know, I raised from foals, there was a period where I tried to use them for lesson horses because they were kind of hanging around not doing that much. And I thought, oh, you know, we could use them too. Those two mares were very intolerant of the learning stages of people and actually almost to the day, both like started biting people. They just get mad. They go, you know what, you stink and I'm going to bite you. Nothing personal, you know. And those horses never bit anybody in their whole lives. You know, I've owned them their whole lives. But they were just all used to a certain level of feel and a level of communication. And so that was like asking Ginger Rogers to dance with, you know, Freddie Flintstone, give up, you know, Fred Astaire and dance with Freddie Flintstone. And they got, you know, the most accurate emotional word I could describe, they got incensed by it. They were insulted almost to be having to, you know, put up with this. They would just look at me like, what is this? And I actually couldn't use them. I had to pull them from, you know, from that kind of use. So they just would not tolerate it. My two old geldings, they were like, ah, you're not that bad. Aaron was a lot worse at this stage. So they were familiar with the beginning stages, you know, in those, you know, when somebody was awkward or too much pressure or too little pressure, their timing, their release, you know, was early or late or any of those things, they just kind of roll their eyes and go, okay, you know what, you're not doing that good, but I'll put up with it. So that's something else to consider, you know, with lesson horses. It's not necessarily the use of the horse, but it's kind of their temperament, their experiences. You can take a horse, you know, out of that environment and just start from the beginning and start rebuilding that confidence in the horse and that tolerance in the horse and then reintroduce it back into the you know, lesson program that you have, maybe having advanced riders, you know, get that horse more solid, you know, things like that. Even colts now, you know, I used to start colts for folks, but I realized that, you know, I was riding these colts to a level that when the person went to ride it, that colt had trouble because it wasn't used to, you know, somebody being out of rhythm, you know, in the riding, and used to somebody maybe leaning one way or the other or too hard on the reins, things like that. So I actually, you know, in recent years when I start colts, I actually get them used to less than ideal feel. I'd pick up the reins too fast on purpose. I'd, you know, bounce and be out of sync, you know, when I ride them a little bit. So when they did feel that, they didn't, you know, freak out and go, ah, you know, and get troubled by that. So I actually, and I got this idea from a good friend who has young children, and he said, you know, he said, I'd start these colts, and then my kids would ride them as they got more solid, but the colts would have trouble. And he said, I started doing things, even to a point where he was teaching the colts, he would fall off. He had a big grassy meadow, and the colts would be going along, and he would fall off and teach those colts to turn around and come back to him. Because he said, if my kids ever fell off those horses, I want that horse to turn around and come back. So, you know, that's something to think about, too, that when you are reconditioning this horse to accept, you know, to understand what's being asked of them, but then also to accept the beginning rider, you can be the one, you know, to do that for that horse. So, you know, I don't know the exact scenario that, you know, you're in, but if you have the opportunity that, you know, if you can teach horseback, you be the one to ride that horse and start reshaping the behavior and reconditioning the horse. And the bit that most people need, you know, everybody thinks that, you know, we've got to get a bigger bit or a this bit or a Western bit or an English bit. You know, really what most people need is a bit of knowledge, you know. Because when you go back and start reconditioning the horse, all the horses in the clinic this last weekend were riding with no bit and having incredible results. There's one horse in there that, you know, really stands out in the situation that the owner just really didn't believe that she could get there in just 3 days, but she was riding around in a halter and lead, you know, just with one rein. It was total influence. I like to replace the word control with influence. She had complete influence with her horse. It didn't start like that, and it was a lot of the, you know, good work she did on the ground, you know, with herself and developing her feel, and I helped her make that transition. But the more she let loose of her you know, beautiful Arab gelding that's designed to go, you know, do 100-mile endurance rides, and, you know, he was just walking along. The more she let loose of the rein, the more he just dropped his head. He looked like an old cow pony in there. So sometimes it's not we get kind of, you know, attached to a certain device or a certain tool that's going to, you know, fix a behavior. But it's really about our approach. How do we change the horse's mind about what's being asked of them? And that's really the art of horsemanship. And to me, just in conclusion here, the study of horsemanship is a vast study. It's vast. And the, you know, act of riding, to me, is one slice of this, you know, bigger study of horsemanship. But everything that you do with horses, from how you approach them to how you put them away to how you, you know, it's feeding time, you know, loading them in the trailer, you know, riding with a group, riding alone, riding, you know, in an arena, outside of an arena, you know, on a windy day, you know, everything is all tied into this same communication, the same idea of how do we interact with these horses? How are we able to hold a conversation in every situation under every condition? So I was driving down the road today, and the mounted police unit in our town here was out doing drills in a big soccer field. And I had a little bit of time. I pulled over, sat down with my dog, and just watched from a distance. And if you ever want to see, you know, what a high demand on a horse, it's one of the last few, you know, true activities, the true uses of horses for a job that we have in our society today. Dan Moyer, who cowboys up in Colorado, he uses his horse for his work. These police officers use these horses for their work. But and you're using a horse for your work to give lessons. And so those horses require, you know, everybody should give the horses the type of communication and teaching and experiences to prepare them for anything and everything. But these kinds of activities are the ones that require, if the horse is going to continue to be used for your livelihood, they require, you know, you have to help that horse develop to that level of skill and ability to be able to use it for the purpose that you're, that you have them employed for. I mean, if you think about, you know, an employee, you would give the employee the type of training that they would need to be able to perform, you know, well for your business or for your purpose. So, you know, maybe think of that for the horse. How do I give that horse what it needs to be able to do the job that I'm asking of it? And horses love doing a job. You know, please don't get me wrong. Horses love a job. Most horses are so bored out of their minds because we're just asking so little of them relative to what their ability is. So I really want to admire you for being in the industry, to helping educate people, and hopefully that will give you a few insights and ideas, maybe a few little changes here and there that can, you know, help that horse stay in that program to be able to help more people, you know, enjoy this wonderful hobby, this wonderful sport and activity that we all enjoy.
Wow, thanks, Karen. Once again, a little question about bits is really just the tip of the iceberg in, as far as horsemanship goes.
And I had to stop myself. That's not all I want to say, but that is a really good topic that we've had on the list for shooting video, is a specific discussion on bits and bridles and everything, you know, that's out there. I mean, there are literally, you know, there's got to be thousands of different approaches and ideas. It's not just Western and English. There's every kind of thing under the sun. So, you know, that's definitely on the list for shooting video now that our temperature is just about to stay below 100. We're having a pretty warm fall here this year. I think it was about 95 today. So we'll get out there and start shooting more videos and more education and getting that out there for people.
Well, we're at the top of the hour already. I want to mention two upcoming events. Karen, next week you're going to be in Chilliwack, British Columbia, Canada, for the main event Horse Expo, which is, I believe, the biggest horse expo in Canada. And then the following week you will be at a three-day clinic in London, Ontario, just outside of Toronto. For all of you who are nearby, come on over and participate in the clinic. If you're within driving range in the northern states, come on up and see Karen in Canada, or even if you want to fly in to a big event, an expo in BC, this would be a great one to come to. So there's plenty of opportunity to see Karen if you can make it. And otherwise, keep sending in your questions to the teleseminar, and we'd be happy to answer those. Karen, do you have anything you'd like to add to before we wrap up tonight?
No, I just am so looking forward to getting back up to Canada. I was there earlier this year, and you know, always enjoy myself. I really have a great time. And what's so fun about you know, traveling to different parts of the country and even outside of the United States is that no matter where you go, the cultures may be totally different for the people, and yet for the horses, the culture is the same. So I really enjoy being able to interact with horses in, you know, different environments, different backgrounds, you know, so many different variables, and really have a great time, you know, as long as people, I find that people, you know, when they keep their sense of humor about horses and don't get too serious about things, we can, you know, really make this a lot of fun for people and the horses, make learning fun again, you know, for horses. Sometimes, you know, we get so serious about things and we get so stressed about things, but sometimes it's just about taking a step back, considering, you know, something, you know, you just hadn't thought of before. And sharing knowledge is obviously, you know, my passion. And one of my favorite sayings is that secondhand gold is as good as new. You know, it doesn't matter how old the gold is, it still has the same value per ounce as something that's being pulled out of the ground right now. And that's how I like to think of knowledge, is that it's just, you know, pieces of gold that we just take, and it's very dear to us. I enjoy the opportunity to be able to share knowledge with people, the knowledge that's been shared with me, and all the knowledge that these horses, you know, make available to us. They're such special creatures in our life, and I just really enjoy the opportunity to you know, share these insights with folks. So look forward to it.
Thanks, everyone, for joining us in tonight's teleseminar and for sending in your questions. Please send them in for next month as well. Karen, thanks for your time to answer these questions to benefit our horses and help us enjoy them more. So thank you, everyone. We will see you in November.
Thanks, everybody. Happy Halloween.